Welcome to Personal Landscapes. I'm your host, Ryan Murdoch. You can find links for today's episode and other conversations on Books About Place at ryanmurdoch.com. James Salter is the best American writer you've probably never read. His sentences are fractured jewels. The details are closely observed. The image is poetic. Every page contains an observation I want to write down. His background is also unusual. He was a fighter pilot in the Korean War and a successful screenwriter. Three of his books place him among the greatest post-war American novelists, despite bad reviews and poor sales on publication. His prose was widely respected by other writers, but he didn't get the recognition he deserved until his 80s. As you'll hear in today's conversation, I only read him for the first time 3 months ago. I set out to track down every Salter book I could find, and that's when I stumbled across a new study by one of our most prolific literary biographers. Jeffrey Myers is the author of an astonishing 55 books of biography and literary criticism, including works on Ernest Hemingway, Scott Fitzgerald, Humphrey Bogart, and John Huston, and he's still publishing every week at the age of 85. We had a wide-ranging conversation about James Salter and some of the other writers he's known. I think you'll really enjoy this one. Before we jump in, I want to take a second to tell you about my new book. It's called A Sunny Place for Shady People, and it's about 6 years I spent on the island of Malta. It begins with comedy and culture, but like my stay there, it ends in a very dark place. I watched an organized criminal network take over the government of a European Union member state with the widespread support of its citizens. It culminated in the brutal car bomb assassination of a writer I admired, the investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. The office of the Prime Minister was implicated in her murder, but no politicians have been arrested or charged. One perceptive blurb described my book as a combination of A Year in Provence and The Godfather, and I guess that sort of sums it up. A Sunny Place for Shady People is available now from Trinity University Press and booksellers everywhere. I hope you'll check it out. And now, here's my conversation with Jeffrey Myers on the writer James Salter. I think we should start by orienting those who haven't yet discovered this wonderful writer. So, who was James Salter?
I think James Salter is unique among American writers. Went to West Point. He became a fighter pilot in the Korean War. 100 missions fighting Russian MiGs over the Yalu River between North Korea and Communist China. He was a very successful Hollywood screenwriter. 1 year, he had 3 movies out, which is like a lifetime's achievement for many people. He didn't like screenwriting. He was using it to finance his novel writing. And then I think he's a very great writer. That's really what my book is about, his achievement. On top of that, we were personal friends. I didn't meet him till he was 80. He was about 14 years older than me. But I knew him during the last 10 years of his life. And I saw him twice. We lived far apart. I was in Colorado. And he was in Bridgehampton. And he did have a house in Aspen in Western Colorado. But by that time, I had left. So I saw him twice in Bridgehampton at the end of Long Island. On my way to Europe, I would stop in New York and get a car and drive out to see him. And we got along well. He's a manly man. He's a good talker. He's well-read. He's cultured, knows everybody. And I want to say that my opinion of Salter is not my own. It's not personal. I'm not the only one who thinks this. In the back of the book, I have tributes from a dozen writers, Susan Sontag and Joyce Carol Oates and Richard Ford and the poet and president of the Guggenheim, Edward Hirsch. And I won't sit there reading them, but I'm saying there's a lot of people who really admire Salter, but he's still not well known. And my book is trying to make him better known than he is.
That's what really shocked me about it. Even I discovered his work quite recently, despite having known his name. You've got a really good quote in the book here that sort of sums up something about his writing. You say his lyrical evocation of people and places, of luxurious decadence and the danger of death are unsurpassed in contemporary literature. So could you give us a sense of what you mean?
Well, we have combined style, which he's praised for. Richard Ford said something like word for word, he's the best writer we have, best living writer we have. So it's high style. Every sentence, every paragraph is really beautifully crafted. There's no sloppiness. There's no casualness. And then his experience in the Air Force, in films, he's a perceptive observer, as all novelists must be. And he, in light years, he writes about wealthy people whose lives are breaking up. And there's one part, I might read it at the end if you just want a half a page of his best. Should I read it now?
Sure, yeah, please.
I think this will get people's appetite up, I think. I didn't plan to read, but this is from Light Years. Salter had daughters, and this is a description of the main character's daughter being seduced by a sort of worthless guy. And if you have a daughter, you imagine you want to protect her and you want her love life to be satisfying. Anyway, Veery is the name of the character. Veery's love for his children reflects Salter's paternal tenderness and affection. The girl's name is Daniela. In Danny's painful rite of passage, Veery discovers that his daughter has a lover whom she cares for more than she loves him. So the father here is being replaced by the lover. Danny falls in love with a worthless would-be sculptor. He lives in a squalid studio, attractively bohemian to a well-bred girl, and assembles pieces of wood. He leads her to his high bed, mounted on four columns, and in a brilliant scene, takes her as if by right. Her passive eagerness for sexual experience is touchingly contrasted to his laid-back lechery. That's my introduction. Here's what Salter writes. He knelt beside her and stroked her hair. She trembled beneath his kisses. Every part of her consciousness was willing, compelled. As he lifted the dress from her raised arms, they wilted as if powerless. His hands were slipping gently inside the elastic of her panties. The marvelous dumb mound, hair pressed flat, is revealed to the light. He touches her. It's as if she is killed. She cannot move. He was naked, and his body was scalding her. She was helpless. He was parting her knees. I mean, you can't get more vivid than that. Sexy.
And beautiful writing.
But not pornographic. It's really high art describing a sexual union that's not very satisfactory. We don't know how Danny responds, but it's obviously not going to last very long. And this is her first experience, so she's a bit frightened and apprehensive. And this guy just takes her and then dumps her. And the father imagines this, and he can't protect her. So I find this very moving as a father of a daughter and also as a writer. And I can imagine Salter. I met one of his daughters. He had three daughters and two sons by two marriages. One daughter, as you read in the book, died in this freak accident. And I finally got to the bottom of that. A lot of people mention it, but nobody really described what happened and how it happened. And the one daughter, second daughter, ran a publishing company in Paris, quite successful, translating English language writers into French. Not she doing it herself, but she arranging it. And she was a bit annoyed that I was there at the same time, so she couldn't get full attention of Salter. But I was there first, and she came after I had arranged to see him, and I couldn't change my plans because I was just between planes on the way to Europe. So she was a bit frosty and went to the beach, and she sat separately from us, which I thought was kind of weird, hostile, attractive, looked a bit like Jim, had a little boy about 10 years old. He was very sweet and bilingual in French and English. And I was drawn to the boy, his grandson. I thought that's what I looked like when I was that boy's age. Maybe I was imagining it, but I had pictures of myself at that time. And normally she's the kind of hostile, aggressive woman that I didn't really warm to, but I felt sorry for her. But I think she was unhappy. She had had this love affair, and she had this boy, and she didn't have a husband or father. And I think she was a good mother, but she was vying for Salter's attention, and he was paying more attention to me, and that really annoyed her because he knew her from her birth, and he was only meeting me for the first time on my first visit. So there was tension, and Salter's wife said, "She's called the general. She's so bossy, and she's always like this, and I'm glad you're here to help break the ice and be a buffer between me, Kay, the wife, who the daughter really resents even much more than she resents me." My wife's about, I don't know, 20 years younger than Jim, I'm not sure. More of a rival to the daughter. So there was a bit of tension there, which was slightly unpleasant, but also interesting. There was a little edge to it all, a little fire boiling under the whole thing.
It almost sounds like a scene right out of one of his books.
Yes, it could be very much so.
Well, so you mentioned that he does draw on his life for his fiction. And I wanted to ask you about the epigraph of your book. So you quoted part of the same epigraph that Salter used for All That Is. You say that only those things preserved in writing have any possibility of being real. Why did you choose that?
I think a writer looks at the world, looks at reality, and then tries to record it. And then it becomes more real, not only real and ever real, but only real and most real. I write every day. I have two more books in press. I've been writing an essay every single week for the last 2 years for a journal in London called The Article. I write for them because I can write about anything I want, no length restrictions, no editing, and it comes out that week. If I send it on Sunday, it comes out the next week. The audience is out there. I think maybe more people are reading it online than reading it in print. Every once in a while, I have something in print, but now, in fact, I have two things in the press, in the mail now. So I think reality for a writer is writing. First, what he sees, and then what he writes. And the writing compounds the reality and makes it realer. He makes it realer than real, because most of the time what's real is not very interesting. What is interesting is what he makes of it. And that's what Salter does, I think, in this passage I just read, just in that one paragraph. To me, anyway, every time I read it, I can imagine this girl being undressed, being lifted onto the bed, this kind of worthless guy she thinks is really great. His art is complete crap, and she thinks it's wonderful because she buys his valuation of himself. And he's done this with lots of girls in his loft, in his bed, in his art. And there's something exciting about it and something sad about it, because you know that the girl is going to be disillusioned. She's young, she's innocent, she's virginal, she's frightened, she's excited, she wants to have sex, but who knows, on the first time, it's usually not the greatest experience in the world. So I think that's what he means, making real, realer by writing about it. That's the way I feel, and I think that's the way. I'm not a novelist, but I think that's the way most writers feel. That's why they're writing, in a way. It's one of the reasons to write. Make your reality real to other people.
I got a sense, too, that there is almost torn between only those, like the past didn't happen unless it was written down, sort of preserving the past, but also the ability of writing to do that. Like you say in your book, that you quote him as saying, "The thoughts of everything that happened, the notes that confirmed it, make it imperishable." But then he also says, to write of someone thoroughly is to destroy them. Like the words endure, but the real events and feelings are lost. It's almost like the writing overwrites the previous experience, and that's what you remember, is the story is how you tell it.
Well, I think there's something to that. When you're older, at my age, in mid-80s, you just spend a lot of time thinking about your past. I think every significant thing that ever happened in my life, I've written about. And I don't have any significant events anymore. I'm just at home on my desk writing. An old man mad about words, as Ford said about himself. So it one of the things it does is help you remember. And maybe the words do replace the experience. Again, what's realer? What you saw, what happened, or what you write? Because when you're writing about it, you're not just recording it, you're making something of it, you're transforming it. And in Salter's case, you're transforming it into high art through style, intelligence, wit, culture, experience. That's why I like him as a writer. So I I should probably go back and tell people that I discovered him rather late, and I read his books, and I wrote to him saying how much I admired the books, but also I mentioned that we had certain friends in common, or at least, certain friends. I mean, James Dickey was a friend of mine, and Irwin Shaw, I knew. Irwin Shaw was a great pal of Salter. Salter really adored Shaw. I thought maybe over-adored him because Salter was coming up, and Shaw, though always popular and successful, was not so well-regarded. And when Shaw was dying, Salter rushed to Switzerland to try to get there in time. Didn't quite make it. He got there a day or two late. But when I saw Shaw toward the end of his life in Mougins, in the French Riviera, he was ill, but he was congenial. He liked to talk. I didn't know Salter at the time. And he brought out this really excellent bottle of wine at 11 in the morning. This is what I was telling Salter as by way of introducing myself through his friends that I knew. I thought that it wasn't a stratagem, but I thought it was a natural thing to do. To say I wasn't just a fan, but I was somebody whose opinion he might someday value if he ever saw what I wrote about him. And he, of course, he liked what I wrote about him, partly because it was favorable, partly because he respected my opinion, partly because he needed the attention. But in some cases, he said I saw things that he didn't see in the story that he wrote, that one on the strand of Tangier. He said, I didn't know all that stuff was in there. He said, it might be in there if you saw it, but I didn't put it in there consciously. He put it in there unconsciously, I suppose. So there's Shaw in this kind of mansion villa on the French Riviera, hobbling around with a stick. He had some hip operation. And he had a servant. And he had a very bossy wife who was a real pain. He had divorced her and then remarried her. And most, I have a whole list of people, writers who divorced their wife and remarried, and about 80 or 90% of them divorced the second time. Anyway, it's a very grand establishment with servants, and there's this bottle of wine, and Shaw said, can we invite Jeffrey to lunch? And his wife said, Irwin, like that, Irwin, you have to give me notice, which is complete bullshit. I mean, the refrigerator was full, the servant was there. Marion didn't have to do anything but sit down at the table. But she was so bossy. And, you know, it would have been fun to have lunch and talk to him for a couple of more hours. And it's clear that when he was on the French Riviera, he didn't have all that many people to talk to about writing, about the thing that really interested him. And he was still writing away. And the Dickey thing was kind of funny because I really liked Dickey a lot. And he was, I went to see him in South Carolina, and we had a very good visit. But Dickey told Salter that he had been a fighter pilot like Salter, and he said, this is typical of Dickey boasting. He said, if I had seen you in the air, I would have shot down your ass. And then I said, but Dickey was a navigator. He wasn't a pilot. He just invented himself as pilot. And Salter just thought that was so funny, and he thought, you'd really expose Dickey, you know, all his bluster and bull. And he never flew a plane in his life. He was just a navigator. And I wrote an essay about Dickey in a book called Privileged Moments. And you know, he's a very colorful character, bigger than, in a way, like Anthony Burgess, you know, kind of bigger than life sort of guy, just bursting. Of course, they were both tall men, but Dickey was really huge. You know, he must have weighed 260 pounds, and he used to be an ex-athlete and very aggressive and very competitive. And he wants to go bow and arrow hunting with me in the swamps of Carolina, you know, that kind of thing. I remember he's one little tiny digression about Dickey. At that time, in his second or third marriage, he had a two-year-old daughter. And the daughter, when we were talking, wandered into the room, hobbled into the room. And Dickey said, really in a loud voice, love you, honey. And the kid just burst into tears and ran out of the room. He scared the hell out of her. So anyway, I had stories like that about mutual friends. And that was, it broke the ice. You know, we had a lot of letters. I think I wrote to him in the fall, and, you know, we corresponded over the academic year. And then in the summer, I went to see him. So I went to his house, and he was standing in the doorway with the door open. And I walked up to the house, and he said, "You're taller than I imagined." In other words, he wanted to be the taller one, but I'm 6'1", and he must have been, I don't know, 5'9" or something. He wasn't short, but he wasn't particularly tall. He said, "I didn't think you'd be that tall." So I thought, I'm a little edge there. I'm taller than him. You know, he's measuring me up against him already, although I wasn't competing with him in any way at all. I just came as an admirer and would-be friend and grateful for the friendship. And we'd go to the beach, and beautiful empty beach, very restricted, almost illegally by the town. You couldn't get on the damn thing unless you had a car with a sticker. And the beach just went on and on with nobody on it. And, you know, the water was nice. It was, I think, June. And we'd sit there having a picnic on the beach and drinking wine and running in and out of the water and talking about books. That's what writers want to talk about. But it's hard to find somebody who knows enough to talk to you about one of my favorite lines in The Maltese Falcon, the film, when Sidney Greenstreet says to Bogart, "I like talking to a man who likes to talk." I like talking to a man who likes to talk. And that's what, see, writers, they lead a lonely life. I mean, you've published books, you know, when you're sitting there, you may have some wife or annoying child around you, but basically you're on your own, you're sitting there. Luckily, I'm quite fluent, so I'm not blocked. I sit there and writing away.
It's interesting that you mentioned The Maltese Falcon. There's, if you ever find yourself in Berlin, there's a tiny cinema, like 15-seat cinema, that does a midnight screening every Saturday of Casablanca, the other great Bogart film, or one of many.
While we're talking about, let me tell you something I discovered. This is not about Salter, but I saw Chinatown the other day, again, movie for the second or third time. And you realize that after three viewings, how much of Chinatown is taken from The Maltese Falcon.
Ah.
It's interesting to see Chinatown with that in mind. It's not stolen, but it's borrowed and transformed in a really interesting way. And for example, the way Faye Dunaway speaks in Chinatown, this kind of, first of all, she lies all the time about who she is and what happened. And just like Mary Astor in the Maltese Falcon, but the way Mary Astor, she speaks in this hesitant way. I haven't been honest with you. And then Faye Dunaway does the same sort of thing. She said, do you know me? Have you ever seen me before? You know, that kind of thing. Interesting, really interesting. A town did a brilliant job, and part of the brilliance was taken over from Maltese Falcon. I had a real contact in Berlin, unfortunately, a very, very old friend of mine that I've known since the 60s. Professor of medieval history at Konstanz. When he retired, he moved to Berlin, and we went to see him in Berlin. I can't remember his address. We stayed with him for 3 days or so. And he's a great, great friend, a really intelligent guy, very learned, many languages, books written in English and German. And he was ill at the time, and I could see he was ill, but he didn't seem to want to talk about it, so I didn't press him on it. But I must say that I found Berlin rather dreary when we were walking around or riding around on the subway. It really reminded me of the previous time when I had gone to East Berlin when it was still communist, and I thought the communist feeling there was still very strong in Berlin. There was something kind of dreary about it that you didn't really get in other German cities that I really liked a lot, like Lübeck, which is my favorite city. Mm-hmm. Because of Thomas Mann and Munich. So it was, there was plenty to see on that museum Insel, and there was a modern art museum, which I thought was terrific, and a Jewish Holocaust and Jewish history museum. So we did all that, and we had Berliner Weiss, and, you know, Michael was a very congenial guy. And I thought he was crazy to leave Konstanz and go to Berlin, because Konstanz was much more attractive for an old man. And he had a sixth-floor apartment overlooking the Bodensee. But he didn't make it quite clear. I mean, he had friends in Berlin, not a girlfriend. But don't let me wander off the point too much.
No, it's really interesting. So you mentioned Salter's unusual background earlier. How important do you think was West Point to the formation of his character?
Well, first of all, his father went there. And his father was first in his class, which is a tremendous achievement. And he was Jewish when, I don't know how many Jews were in West Point that year, but if there was more than one or two or three, I'd be very surprised. I was staying visiting a teacher in Stanford, and his father had gone to West Point, and he pulled out the yearbook of that year. I think it was 1919, something like that. And there was a picture of Arnold Horowitz, his father, first in the class. But he had missed World War One just, and he was too old for World War II. So even though he was first in his class and he was sort of heading to be a general, he didn't have much of a military career. Stalter wanted to go to Stanford or Harvard. I think he got into Stanford, and his father wanted him to go to West Point. So he followed his father's wishes. His father, by this time, was kind of a failure. He was a real estate investor, and I think he didn't invest too well. Obviously, he lost money like everybody else in the crash of 1929. And, you know, Stalter lived well when he was a boy and a teenager, and he went to Horace Mann, which is a very good prep school in New York. And he lived, in posh apartments with doormen and, you know, all that sort of thing. So he went to West Point, and he describes it in Burning the Days. And to me, it just sounded absolutely horrible. I said, you know, how can you take all this shit? You just sit there and you have to do this and you have to do that and you have to polish this and you have to press that and you have to do that and you have to stand here, do that exercise and follow this. And it had nothing to do with being a soldier. It had nothing to do with your ability to fight the enemy, your technical expertise with weapons and planes and tanks. I said, to me, it's just completely stupid. And I don't think I could stand it for a week. He said, well, it shapes you up and puts you into league with all the other people in your class that are doing the same thing. To me, the same stupid thing, but to him, the same thing that sort of molds your character, does it? It's like a fraternity hazing.
Well, and it seemed like he reacted against it in the beginning as well. Like he didn't seem to do very well initially.
No, well, you know, you get points and then you have to march around the parade ground. You know, he's slightly rebellious, but you can't be rebellious in West Point. They just kick you out. And the thing is, he was trained as an engineer. And that's very unusual, too. Mailer was trained as an engineer at Harvard. But very few writers were trained as an engineer.
Do you know of any others that graduated West Point?
I may have mentioned it in the book. I'm just trying to think.
There was one that did some time there, but I don't think graduated.
But one anecdote in my book, which I really love, Salter was very friendly with Saul Bellow at one time. Saul Bellow, I just admire beyond any modern American writer. And they're driving around the mountains outside of Aspen, Colorado, in the Rockies. And Salter went in for old cars. When I drove with him on those visits, the car was almost falling apart. And he had all these little bits of paper falling around in the back seat and on the floor. And what is all this crap? He said, no, those are my notes for my novel. I mean, be careful. You know, I was tempted to put a few of them into my pocket and they probably wouldn't notice, you know, that I can have a bit of Salter, but I left them there. He'd be looking for it. Anyway, the car breaks down. Saul Bellow says, oh, you know, too bad. He gets out of the car and he pulls a book out of his pocket and he sits on the side of the road and he starts reading a book, The Intellectual from New York. Salter pulls out a roll of tape and a screwdriver and a wrench and he pulls up the back hood where the motor on the Volkswagen. And he fixes it. I mean, he's an engineer. He knows how to do all this stuff. Bellow was most impressed. But I think that's a good example of, yeah, it's West Point all these years later. You know, not the Air Force, but he knows how to fix things. He knows how to do things. He knows how to build things. I don't understand. I don't know any of that stuff. I couldn't fix anything.
You said that he also graduated in the top 6% of his class, which I didn't know. Like that, he seems to downplay his achievements in Burning the Days. He doesn't mention how well he did there.
He's a brainy guy. And, you know, I mean, he knew all these subjects that I never took in college. I mean, math and physics and engineering. I remember the hardest course I ever took in college was Navy ROTC to be gunnery and ordnance. This is in the pre-computer days in the 50s. And you're supposed to figure out, you launch a shot from a ship. And the ship is swaying and moving in the wind. And I mean, how the hell are you supposed to figure it out? Some of the engineers could do it. They used to have, I forget what you call it, these boards that hung from their belt pre-computer. Anyway, the course was so difficult that the teacher had to leave during the exams and let everybody cheat or we'd all fail out. It was really weird. I told Salter that. He found that amusing, that the only way to get through is to be encouraged to cheat. But the point is, he could do that stuff, which to me was a complete mystery. And I knew that if I didn't actually finish that course, because I transferred and went to Europe, that if I ever became a naval officer, I certainly wouldn't be in charge of gunnery. I mean, I'd have to be in charge of intelligence or supply or some crappy job, but not anything having to do with shooting off guns. I just didn't get it. I just didn't see how you could ever hit anything, but they did.
Well, so you said, too, that the Korean War revived his military career, and he flew over 100 combat missions in an F-86 Sabre jet. He wrote about his Air Force, his initial flight training in Burning the Days, and this really surprised me. He said that we were expected to solo in a few hours, not less than 4 and no more than 8. If you're not able to take off and land by yourself after 8 hours, you were washed out. Like, that's incredible.
We're always putting the intense pressure on you because that's what it's like when you're flying. But let me go back for a minute. Before the war, when he was flying in America, not in combat, he crashed a plane into a house in Massachusetts.
That's an amazing story.
Lost, and he ran out of petrol. And it was a terrible thing to do. It was amazing that the people who were waiting for their son to come back from the army had gone out of the house when they heard the plane and looked up at the sky thinking the son was coming. And so when Salter crashed into the house, nobody was in the house, so nobody was killed. And he wasn't killed either. He broke some teeth and had a concussion. And there's a photo which I've seen. I didn't have it in the book, but you can see it. I think it's in his book, Gods of Tin, about flying, where the plane is just, the whole first half of the plane is right into the side of the house. And the wings are sticking out of the window, so to speak, in the tail. So this really should have finished his career, but somehow he was protected. They said it was a fault of the plane. It really wasn't. I mean, he admitted it was his fault. Well, he was given bad directions. He wasn't brought back with signals to the field to land. Anyway, it was a disaster. So then for years, he had to just do transport flights from bases in California, bringing people to the Pacific, to Japan or Guam or whatever, Hawaii, whatever. He had quite a lot of time in Honolulu. Then when the Korean War starts, when was it, 51 or 53, around there, the early 50s. Then he's needed, and he wants to be an ace. And to be an ace, you have to shoot down 5 planes. So there's some, I think that chapter, the most exciting chapter in the book, it's the non-literary chapter. It's about what the war was like in Korea, who they were fighting, what the MiGs were like as compared to the F-86 or whatever the American planes are called. And what it was like, I mean, he gives you that just as he gives you the sense of that girl being seduced in light years. He really gives you the sense of what it's like to fly in a jet plane in combat.
I don't think I've ever read better descriptions of flying than he's gotten Burning the Days.
Most of the people who do it are Air Force types, you know, not writers. He regretted leaving the Air Force. There's a great scene. He's at a party, and he's being one of the boys. And in some ways, unnaturally, he's yelling louder and drinking more and laughing more and slapping backs more. And somebody comes up to him and says, "Is this the real you?" Something like that. "Is that really you?" And Salter thinks, "No, it's not me. It's not where I belong. I mean, I like flying, and I like aerial combat. But really, I want to be a writer. So I'm going to throw away this career," as he's a lieutenant colonel by then. And he was really heading to be a general, which is quite a big deal. I think he had been an aide to one parent. I had a friend who was a colonel in the Air Force. And we talked about Salter quite a bit. He said, I said, "What do you need to be general?" He said, "You need a patron. You need somebody high up who's going to pull you up." Same thing in the Foreign Service. So he left the Air Force with great regret. But let's go back to the fighter pilot. I mean, he just describes what aerial combat is like. And he himself almost gets shot down. He misses a chance to shoot down another plane. He said he pulled the flaps down by mistake, which slowed him down when he needed to speed up to catch. You have to get behind the person so that you can shoot them, but they can't shoot you since their guns are facing forward. But finally, toward the end, he has this choice. One hand, you want to get a kill. You want to shoot down one plane. It's very hard to shoot down five. Then you're an ace. On the other hand, you have 100 missions, every single one dangerous. What if they come behind you, which they're trying to do? And MiGs have some advantages over the American planes. I forget what, either they're faster or their gun power is stronger. Their pilots maybe not as well trained. They'd escape across the Yalu River into China, and the Americans were not allowed to chase them into China for fear of starting a war with China, though they did chase them. He says this, and it's really interesting. But they'd go over the Yalu River when they were forbidden to do so and not try to shoot down a plane, even in communist China, which probably would have caused a lot of political trouble. So you have a desire to shoot down a plane. You have a desire to, not a cowardly desire, but a human desire to survive 100 missions. And that's your conflict. But your desire to kill is greater than your desire to survive. In other words, you're willing to take the chance that you need to get a kill. And he describes what it's like. And he said, what is it? You have 5 seconds, 10 seconds, whatever it is, an incredibly short amount of time when you have the chance to kill the other plane. And when he does kill, he describes the pilot sort of tumbling out of the plane. I'm not sure he even had time to open his parachute. He's just kind of falling from the sky. And of course, you go shooting by. You just get a glimpse of him. You can't sit there watching him fall. He takes, how long does it take? A half a minute or something, or a minute to fall out of a plane to hit the ground. Meanwhile, you're shooting away. That's great stuff. I have a reading at a bookstore in Marin on Sunday, and I think I might read that non-literary fighter pilot part of the plane.
Yeah, it's an incredible description. And you've said, too, that his leaving the military, it was more emotionally searing than the breakup of his marriage. Like, it felt like throwing away everything he'd done in life up to that point, and everything that meant anything to him up until then, to just take this chance and to try to write fiction.
He said it was the toughest decision of his life. The point is, he was very high in the Air Force with a promising future, and he had to start from the bottom with no training as a writer and no experience in the literary world, which led to his hero worship of writers and editors even. Editors, to me, are the enemy. They just interfere with your work. They have nothing else to do but bother you. You know, they don't even know when the text is well written and edited expertly by my wife before I hand it in. And then they just start messing around with you, and they just don't know what they're doing. They just waste your time, and half the time I just have to take the thing away from them. But Salter thinks, some people he admired, like George Plimpton, and I knew Plimpton slightly. Plimpton's an impressive guy, there's no question about it. And he was the first one to publish Salter in the Paris Review and also in his own imprint, which was, I forget what it was, Paris Review Editions, which was part of Doubleday. And certainly Plimpton's impressive. You know, he's very tall and handsome, and he's a tremendous athlete, and he knows everybody, and he's rich, and he comes from an aristocratic family and all the rest of it. But he also admired this guy Phelps, who I thought was absolutely third rate. Never really did anything significant as a writer. Somehow he's this kind of francophile. He thought Colette was a great writer, so Salter picks up Colette. I think Colette's a complete waste of time for somebody like Salter, way over Colette. And he admired Erwin Shaw because Erwin Shaw was a pal.
So you've talked about this in the book too. You said that Phelps brought out that was the most egregious example of undeserved admiration, and that he brought out Salter's worst traits. So what did you mean by that?
Phelps, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, a kind of mannered style, which he sometimes indulged in. Francophilia, so that everything in France was great. I used to go to France part of every summer and sometimes rented houses there for a week or two. But I always find Paris, apart from the museums, kind of overwhelming. You know, it's just too big, too difficult to deal with. I hate going into the metro. And you know, there's a kind of snobbery about how great everything is in France. You know, kissing girls on the street corner and, you know, the way you get the romance in all the American movies. To me, it's not romantic at all. But I think the first time I went there, when I was a teenager, I had this tremendous car crash in Scotland. And I made my way, it was during the vacation from the university in the spring. And by the time I got to Paris, I was really depressed. And I was shocked. I was delayed because I almost got killed in the car just went off the road and turned over on the ice. So that bit of Paris always stuck with me. Of course, I didn't know a word of French in those days. So it's that. It's the Francophilia, admiring people like Colette, mannered style, and admiring somebody like Phelps who never really did anything except do a couple of anthologies. I mean, what's there to admire? I just don't see it.
You said also, you mentioned his chapter titles as well, came from this sort of influence, these obscure chapter titles.
I don't think those chapter titles did him much good. Burning the Days, I suppose, is the bad example. He liked the exotic names of characters, like that character called Viri. I think his real name is Vladimir, in fact.
Right, but yeah.
Viri. And Anatole Broyard, who wrote a very negative review of Light Years, just shows how much crap Salter had to take from reviewers when he was first starting out. Very discouraging. And Salter said, he criticizes the name of Viri, Anatole, Anatole. <you know? laughs> I thought that was really rather good, Anatole. I don't see, but you know, I can't remember all the names. I know he had a Japanese name, and one of his stories is the Goetheneum, which is this Rudolf Steiner thing in Switzerland. The whole thing was the most half-assed. If you look into Steiner and Goetheneum, I mean, you don't need that, but or Amstrand de Tanger, you know, why have a German name? Why not just on the beach of Tangier? He's trying to do something different. He's straining for an effect, and that's a weakness in my opinion. I didn't want to say, oh, well, you see, he's not all that great. He has weaknesses too. But I didn't want somebody to say, well, all it is on your knees adoration. You know, I just want it to be somewhat critical. And I traced the criticism to Phelps and to people like, and there was another, well, this guy, Robert Jenna, he was okay. He gave Salter a lot of help. He published his book and he gave him money to the interviews with Graham Greene and Nabokov, which was great stuff. Somebody that he admired was the captain of the Harvard swimming team. Well, to me, that's not impressive. I mean, so what?
So why do you think he overestimated people like Phelps?
Because he was insecure, not in his writing, but as a man in the world of writers that he was unfamiliar with. So Phelps, I never talked about Phelps with Salter. I didn't want to get into I really had not gone into it when I knew him personally. He's insecure and he thinks Phelps is the real thing. He can't tell the difference between a really great writer like Sol Bellow. I mean, who's can't get better than him. I rate Salter high, but I rate Bellow higher than Salter. In fact, just yesterday I finished an essay on Mr. Snemmler's Planet. I read it for the third time and it's absolutely brilliant. It's one of these things, you read it again, you really start seeing more things in there. I mean, Bellow is absolutely great. I think Bellow and Nabokov are the two great post-war writers. But I think after Bellow and Nabokov, I would play Salter. And it's not idiosyncratic. So he finds this guy who seems to be cultured and sophisticated and loves France. I mean, I like being in France, but I didn't think it was all that great. I got much more of a thrill being in Spain or Greece or in Bali or in Jerusalem. Or in Venice. Those are the places that really...
But not in Berlin, clearly, you said.
Berlin was sad. I thought, Michael, I didn't say to him, why is he living here? You know, he couldn't live anywhere. Constance was really, really beautiful.
So there's a volume of Salter's letters between him and Robert Phelps It just landed in my mailbox the other day. I just got my hands on it. I haven't read it yet. But
what's it called?
Memorable Days.
Oh yeah.
So are there any other collections of his letters, or do you think any will be published?
They will be published. I published some of his letters, excerpts in my book. I could use anything I wanted that he wrote to me. And he's a good letter writer too.
Yeah, that's it caught my attention. I wondered if there's any more.
I wanted to publish his letters to me. And I won't say who the problem was, but I was obstructed by the estate, which I thought was a mistake because it would help his reputation. And it would inspire somebody to do a whole edition of his letters. And I had set it up with, I think it was the London Review of Books, to publish a good spread of 20 letters or whatever. But I was blocked on that, even though I had written permission. The permission was withdrawn. If I wanted to go ahead, I could have, because I had written permission, and I could say the hell with the withdrawn permission. I'm just going on the first one. But I didn't feel like arguing. There wasn't that much in it for me. I published some of his stuff in my book, and if they didn't want the letters, then they can do without them. And when the edition comes out, I'm sure as hell not giving my letters to that editor. If I couldn't publish them myself, I'm not giving them to someone else. So it's a problem when the family takes over. I was a very close friend of the Catholic novelist J.F. Powers, Jim Powers. Do you know his work?
No.
Oh, look into
it. I just know the name. Yeah.
J.F. Powers, absolutely brilliant writer, hardly known at all. He won the National Book Award for a book called Mort Durban, M-O-R-T-E-D.
I've heard of this, yes.
U-R-B-A-N. And when his daughter took over, and she wrote a very negative introduction to a reprint of one of his novels. And then when she edited his letters, she attacked her father in the introduction. So when she asked for my letters, Jim Powers' letters to me, I said, no, I mean, I don't want to get into a book where you're attacking my friend who happens to be your father. So my letters didn't go in there. She said, I can't tell you what it costs me to ask you to do this. I mean, what a stupid way to ask permission. She just should have said in a polite way and not, you know. So they want control, but they don't know what they're doing. They should be taking expert advice from somebody like me or me, who's a friend and admirer, and not go half-assed on their own and either hurt their reputation by omission or hurt their reputation by criticism. Who needs Powers' daughter to criticize him? He has plenty of other people who criticize him. What he needs is people to admire him. I published a number of things about him, and my best chapter in Privileged Moments was about Powers. He lived almost in the woods in northern Minnesota in some obscure Catholic college, and very hair-shirt existence. And I went to see him, I think, three times. I used to go to Harborfront, that very, very good literary festival in Toronto. And on the way back from Harborfront to Colorado, I'd always stop in Minneapolis and then drive up and see Power. Well, that's off the subject. But it's like Salters in the sense that he's not widely known. I befriended him because I admired his work. I went to see him three times. I wrote about him. Wrote some really very admiring essays about him. And it's great fun to see him. He's a very witty guy. This is what I do as a biographer. I seek out people who interest me. And even though I was living in Colorado a lot of the time, which is not on the coast, I got invited a year ago to talk at the Y in New York, which is a big deal. And I said, well, who's going to pay my hotel and my plane fare? She said, oh, I thought you lived in New York. They can't imagine anybody living west of the Hudson River. Every single writer has to live in New York. You just walk out of your apartment over to the Y and that's it. And they give you lunch if you're lucky. But flying from San Francisco to New York, forget it, you know? I mean, maybe she thought I'd pay my own if I had some business or something to do in New York, but I didn't. And I didn't feel like flying across the country, spending 2 days of my life to fly there and back just to give a talk in the Y. But anyway, if I'm in New York, I could write to them again and say, I'm here, or I'm going to be here. How about it? So there is a parallel in a way, without not getting off the subject, between Powers and Salter and my relation to both of them. Admiring their work, feeling they're not recognized, seeking them out by mail, going to visit them, writing about them, enhancing their reputation, trying to be a good friend personally and as a, certainly Jim needed some, they're both called Jim, by the way, Powers needed some encouragement. 10 years between books. I said, come to Colorado. I'll give you $1,500 for a lecture, which is a lot. I'll pick you up at the airport. You could stay at my house. I will feed you. All you have to do is give this one talk because nobody knows who you are anymore. He said, well, I just as likely to meet you at the Potala in Tibet. And I said, okay, next Monday, 12 o'clock at the Potala in Tibet. I'll meet you there. That's the same climate as Minnesota, so you'll feel right at home. These are great things in my life to know these two men and to think that I could be friends with them.
I want to come back to something you said about Salter's obsession with France. You said that his infatuation with France and Frenchness was more a nostalgic evocation of Hemingway's Paris in the 1920s than his own encounter with the unromantic modern city. So it wasn't that he liked France so much now. It was a projection of, you know, the life that these previous literary giants lived there.
That very strongly, because Hemingway's Movable Feast, I mean, Paris is just, you know, paradise. Sure, you could live, you could get a great feast, you know, for a dollar. You could spend a week in skiing in Austria for $5. So first of all, it was cheap. And Hemingway's thing about being poor was just complete bull. Everything was cheap, and his wife had a trust fund, and he had money from being a reporter. I mean, he wasn't poor. But everything about Paris, I mean, Hemingway makes it so attractive. But that was the 20s. And when you go, and Bella went back there after the war, had some kind of grant, I can't remember which, maybe been a Guggenheim or something, Rockefeller grant. And he was very negative about Paris. Well, post-war Paris, you know, it wasn't too jolly, really, in 1946, after the war. People go to Paris, I think, even today. Just like they go to Pamplona and they think it's like Hemingway in the 20s. And, you know, I've been to Pamplona, but not during the San Fermin Festival. The idea of staying up all night and getting drunk and then getting my ass gored by some bull for no particular reason. I don't feel I have to show off to anybody. I like reading about it. I love movies about bullfighting. I've been to 50 bullfights. I lived in Spain for 4 years. So I think that's, if I might say so, a rather shrewd observation on my part. He's going back to a Paris that doesn't exist. And just as Hemingway glorified it in the 20s, as it was in the 20s, he wrote it in the around the early 60s, late 50s. So Salter glamorizes it too. I don't think the French are particularly friendly in the way the Spanish and Italians and even Greeks are. In these other countries, if you try to speak the language, they encourage you. But in France, if you make a mistake, they get annoyed. Your grammar is not correct. Oh, my French grammar is never correct. So, I can read it and I can speak it, but it's not perfect by any means. So in those days, I used to go in the 50s and 60s. I mean, very few people spoke English. So yeah, that's true. It's not, from my own experience of 40 different visits to France, when I went to Europe and I went to England and Spain and Italy and Greece every summer. That was a great thing about being a teacher. It just wasn't like Salter. But Salter, it's part of what he felt and part of what he imagined and partly what he felt editors wanted when he wrote about France. Didn't want to hear how dreary it was.
I wonder if that's what attracted me. One of the things that attracted me to his work as well, because I've often felt like I wanted to live in the 20s or 30s, you know, the golden age of flying boats and cocktail culture. Like that was my lost era that I would have loved to experience. And also he mentions, I can't remember if it was in your book or in his memoir, he mentioned Lawrence Durrell's house in the south of France that seemed to sum up all the glamour of the literary foreign independent life for him. And I was a great fan of Lawrence Durrell as well. I went to the south of France. I saw his house and wrote about a magazine feature about it. I couldn't get in. Nobody answered the bell. So I went back at night with a bottle of wine and scaled the wall and had a drink with his ghost, you know, in the yard of this place. So
good.
His comments on the Alexandria Quartet, that kind of, I thought, oh, geez, maybe there's some thread here that I connected with in Salter's work as well. Did he know Durrell?
Yeah, I know. Durrell's a master of evocation of place, though. I think that book, Bitter Lemons, about, is it Cyprus or Corfu?
Cyprus, yeah.
He really brings it alive. When I went back to the Alexandria Quartet, it seemed to be overdone somehow, and I didn't like it as much the second time. But his travel books, I think, are terrific. Reflections on a Marine Venus, and he wrote a book about
Prospero Cell.
Yeah, I mean, he's really a wonderful travel writer. And he follows the tradition of D.H. Lawrence, who I think paved the way as for being a modern travel writer. In fact, I have a book about that called The Legacy of D.H. Lawrence, about how he influenced later writers. And I wrote the chapter in the book about Lawrence as a travel writer and who followed in his tradition.
That's interesting. I'll check that out.
And
I like Sea in Sardinia. That was one of my favorites.
When in doubt, move. That's really terrific. What's the motto? Yeah. When in doubt, move. I think it's your motto too, because you seem to be moving around a lot.
Yeah, fair, but not enough lately. I'm going to Italy next week, but that's just a short break. I want to ask you also two more things, if it's okay. I wanted to ask you about Salter's core themes, because we haven't really touched on that very much. So you've said in your book that in A Sport and a Pastime and Light Years, that he writes with sophistication, style, and skill about the search for an ideal way of life. What do you mean by that? He was searching for, you know, in Sport, he explores a purely sensual existence with the coldly erotic eye of Henry Miller and the precise observation of Henry James. And Light Years portrays more of a family-centered vision of family and work, but in both are undermined by this sort of the crushing discovery that you can't have everything and the pang of bitterness and loss. So the ideal way of living never quite measures up.
He creates this ideal life, and then he knows that it can't be sustained. But what does it mean in the first place? It means having money and living well. Salter lived modestly. He didn't have money until maybe right at the end. He had a couple of big contracts, and he got $100,000 from the Whiting Fund or some fund. He said it was encouraging young writers to write and encouraged me to stop writing. He said I didn't need the money anymore. So you need money so you can live grandly in big houses and eat well and travel as you like and dress well and drink well and have glamorous women. And maybe there's something empty about all that in Light Years. How can you keep it up? It's just too good. It's too nice. You come crashing down to reality when you start having personal problems with your wife. There's a theme of loss. And so sometimes somebody could write a book on this. The great theme of modern literature is loss. And the great writers have suffered tremendous loss. I take two examples of Nabokov, who was a multimillionaire from his uncle's inheritance. I mean, he lost absolutely everything there was to lose. And that's why when he came to America, he never wanted to own a house, because he could never equal what he had. This is related to Salter, too. And he might lose it again. He might lose everything he had for the second time. So he's driving around the West in the car all the time, never stopping anywhere except at a hotel. And Conrad, he lost his whole childhood, lost his country, lost his language. First his mother died, then his father died when he was still a boy. Hates the Russians. I mean, how'd you like to spend your childhood with a failed Polish revolutionary, bitter father in not Siberia, because it was north of Moscow, but it was in the Arctic Circle in Vologda. You take any writer, just about. Bruce trying to recapture the past. Can you do it? Well, maybe you can do it in the novel, but you can't do it in your life. Or Joyce, just that one day in Dublin in 1904 or 6, whenever it was. he lost it too, because he just gave up Ireland and went to live in Trieste and in Switzerland and in Paris. I think this idea of losing and trying to recapture the loss through writing, all that time in sport and pastime, when the young man is with the girl and they're driving around in this beautiful car, that's a brilliant tour de force, the way he can describe sex scenes maybe 16 different times, all differently, but all with the sense of it's not going to last. The girl wants it to last. She wants to get married. I mean, she's just not up to it. I mean, she's just a shop girl. She's not even that beautiful, but she's just very sexually responsive and is eager to do anything sexually to please him. So they drive around, and you can see their life is wonderful. I mean, they're just driving this beautiful car through the countryside, eating these meals and screwing, and yet there's something missing. That's the loss.
Well, there's always a sense that they exist in this little bubble that they're carrying around with them, and he's conscious of the fact that it's going to end. So there's sort of the sense of doom hanging over it, or you know, this, that there's soon to be an end to all of this. But they hang on to it for a while, but they're isolated from the world. They're not interacting with the world around them, really.
We see it. The man sees it. The girl never sees it. And then, I don't know, maybe it was a mistake to finish him off in that car crash in America. The girl gets married and has a kind of marriage that he dreaded if he married her. They have nothing to talk about. That's the problem. It's all physical. It's great, especially when you're young. You want to have sex every day, or maybe more than once a day. And the girl is just, but she comes out of the shower and you notice she has pimples on her back. And that's a real step down. I mean, it's Salter's signal that this is not going to last. It's a horrible little touch, but it's very telling, I think, very revealing, and sort of feel sorry for the girl. I mean, nice girls can have pimples on their back, but not when they're trying to attract a rich American who's so brilliant that he couldn't stay in Yale, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting the way he peppers in these telling details. So in such a subtle way, you could almost breeze over it because the sentences are so short and succinct. They're so compressed, his imagery, and lyrical, that you get caught up in the rhythm of it. And then you go back and look and thought, oh, these details are leading up to this sort of feeling of an ending coming.
It's a great pleasure reading Salter, a great joy. So I would urge readers and listeners to this program to read one of his books. Start with Burning the Days, probably, the memoir, or Light Years, or A Sport in the Pastime. It's very rich. It's very rewarding. And now that if you've listened to this and you know more about Salter, I think the attraction to his work would be stronger, greater. Yeah. But there's a real payoff. You'll really get a lot of pleasure out of reading Salter and discovering somebody that you probably didn't know about before, who is, in my opinion, a really, really great writer.
Yeah, it's been my great reading discovery this year. The landmark books, you know, that I'll think about as the highlights of 2024 for sure. I've just been devouring everything I could find since I read Light Years. So, in conclusion, you said that you've said that Salter's masterpieces, A Sport and a Pastime, Light Years, and Burning the Days, place him after Saul Bellow and Nabokov as the best post-war American novelist. So why is he not more widely read today?
It's hard to understand that. Partly because until he was 80, he didn't have much recognition in his lifetime. It was only in the last 10 years of his life, from 80 to 90, so recognition was very slow coming in his lifetime, and even slower coming after he died, which happens, as you know, with writers. When they die, their reputation tends to go down. Also now, when the tremendous, overwhelming emphasis is on women, blacks, and minorities, Salter is not the sort of person to have wide appeal for anybody who determines what's important in literature. That the literary quarterlies that would publish my work on Salter no longer publish literary essays on anybody. Kenyon Review, which was the great literary quarterly in America, founded by John Crow Ransom, the poet, published an important essay of mine on Salter. Now they have memoirs called Mi Abuelita, My Little Granny. I mean, the intellectual level has just crashed, and they're simply not interested in Salter. But I must admit that early on, when I first discovered him, and I was really enthusiastic, and I'd talk to colleagues and friends and say, oh, God, I'm reading Jim Salter. I just think he's terrific. And they'd say, I never heard of him. He didn't push himself. He didn't know how to maneuver in the literary world. He thought it was maybe vulgar. Powers absolutely refused to do anything. I mean, he wouldn't even come and give a lecture in Colorado. I said, Jim, he spends the whole morning writing a sentence and the whole afternoon crossing it out. You know, he's just absolutely getting nowhere for 10 years. And both Jims, their little joke with me was that I was the Anthony Trollope of writers. I was just turning out a novel every single week, nonstop literary performance, cascade of words pouring out of me. And they were these kind of block, constipated, brilliant, you know, Moe Joust writers, you know, who just squeezed out one word at a time. Of course, it wasn't true at all, but they thought that was funny. And I went along with that. You know, so Power said, when you get in an airplane, do you ask the steward to knock up a desk so you can write a novel while you're crossing the Atlantic? You know, that kind of thing. And Salter said the same kind of thing. So read Salter, listeners, and read J.F. Powers when you finish reading Salter, because even Ryan didn't know about Powers. And he's a Catholic novelist, highly praised by Evelyn Waugh, for example, who didn't praise people very easily, though he was soft on Catholics, obviously, Waugh was. When we finish the formal, I wouldn't mind asking you a couple of questions about your life and what you're doing, but that has nothing to do
with the program. In terms of Salter, I hope this helps spread the word about this incredibly good writer, and I hope your book, people will pick this up. It's a beautifully produced book. So,
this is a beautiful book.
It's a great cover.
And the jet plane ready to shoot down a couple of Ruskies, clear the sky of the commies, and win the Korean War. It's a beautiful book. Take off the binding and the color and everything. LSU was really great. Everything I wanted, they agreed to. And it was very smooth sailing. So I have a book called Parallel Lives, about 20 comparisons from Freud and Thomas Mann down to Diane Arbus and Sylvia Plath. And then a year from now, in July next year, 45 Ways to Look at Hemingway.
I'll look forward to both of those. So thank you, Jeffrey, for sharing your memories of one of the 20th century's literary giants and for your wonderful book. I really, really enjoyed it.
Good to talk.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Personal Landscapes. If you like the podcast, please give it a rating on iTunes and subscribe through your favorite app. You can find links to today's podcast and more conversations on Books About Place at ryanmurdock.com. You'll also find a donate button if you'd like to contribute to the costs of the show. All donations are greatly appreciated.